from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning, and welcome to What's Next. I'm Emily Watkins, and today we're sharing a conversation I recently had with Dr. Sammy Schock, a disability scholar, professor of gender and women's studies, and author of Black Disability Politics. We discuss her book and the intersections of race and disability.
Thank you so much for joining me on WBFO.
Thanks for having me.
To start, I'd love to have you share a little bit about you, your work, and why you decided to write Black Disability Politics.
Yeah, so I'm a professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My research focuses on disability, race, predominantly Blackness, and gender in contemporary American literature and culture. I'm a fat, Black, queer, disabled woman. And yeah, I've been in the field of disability studies for a long time. Yeah.
And why write this book? Why was it so important in that moment? I know you also made it so people can actually download it as a PDF, so it's accessible to people.
Yeah, I wanted to write this book because as I said, I've been in the field of disability studies for quite some time. I started taking classes as an undergraduate. I was attending conferences throughout grad school, and it was pretty common that I would be the only Black person in the room, potentially even at an entire conference. And even though there were other people writing about Blackness and about race in the field of disability studies, there just weren't many Black people in the field, and there still aren't a ton of us. And, you know, as someone who was really trained as a Black feminist theorist, I've always felt like these fields needed to be more in conversation with one another. And so this book, Black Disability Politics, really became my attempt to not simply educate people in disability studies about the particularities of the Black disabled experience and Black disability history, but actually really try to bring folks in Black studies, AFAM studies, into the field of disability studies. Because I feel like historically the field has been very white, and then we've had folks trying to figure out how to write about race as opposed to bringing in experts in race and helping them figure out how to think about and talk about disability. And so I really wanted it to reach that audience. And then, of course, because it focuses so heavily on activists, advocates, organizers, change makers, including interviewing people, I felt like it was really unethical for me to produce something about activism that isn't accessible to activists. If the point of the book is to get more people to think about this, especially folks outside the academy, then I have to make it accessible to people outside the academy. And so I was lucky that I had research funding that was able to be used to pay to make the book open access. So now people can download it, share it, use it in, you know, reading groups and use it in organizing groups to really think about these issues without having for everyone to have to buy a book.
Absolutely. And can I ask, are there certain barriers to Black academics going into the field of disability studies that you've noticed?
I mean, I think the whiteness of the field and just feeling isolated is part of it. But it's also, there's so many people that just don't know. There's so many people, I think, in Black studies who are actually talking about disability. They're talking about health. They're talking about the disabling impact of police violence and lack of healthcare access, right? Medical racism, these things as disabling forces, but they just don't have necessarily the lens and the connection to a disability community or to disability studies to be able to bring that in. And so that's my hope with the book, is that more folks can see, oh, my work is already kind of doing this. Let me learn a little bit more to have that lens to be able to bring that angle to the scholarship that I'm already focusing on.
And you say in your introduction that you, quote, define Black disability politics as anti-ableist arguments and actions performed by Black cultural workers, unquote. What are some of these arguments or actions you found and carry with you or think about often?
Well, I think one of the arguments is really thinking about the disabling impact of racism. Often in disability studies and in disability communities, there's this sense of, you know, disability pride and not really wanting to focus on the reason someone is disabled, or really saying, you know, disability can happen to anybody and it's just kind of random. But we know that there are populations that are more likely to become disabled because of social circumstances, whether that is race or class. I think in this stage, day and age, we also can think about trans folks being more likely to be disabled by the transphobia of our culture, right? And so I think that a lot of Black disabled activists and Black activists who are thinking around disability are often talking about it not from the place of what are we doing for disabled people, but looking at these structures to say these structures are disabling us, and then we're being blamed for our disability, right? We're being called to say, well, you're not good enough, you're inferior in these ways, without recognizing these circumstances that are either physically or mentally disabling. And so I think that's a major thing that I like to pay attention to and think about how we talk through that disabling impact without making it seem like disability is the most horrific thing that could ever happen to a person, without leaving the people who have been disabled behind to only focus on the system, right? So that both and approach is really important. And then in terms of actions, I think really a lot about care work. Think about the care work that has had to happen inside of Black communities when social structures, governmental structures have left us behind. And that care work is so intrinsic to disability community as well. But again, we're not necessarily using the same language. But that action of we take care of one another, you know, that there are, I've met people that are like, oh yeah, everyone in my family has diabetes, and we just know how to like prepare the food right and to check in on each other. But we don't think of ourselves as like a disabled family, right? But that care work is intrinsic to really like recognizing that we take care of us, right?
Hearing you talk about that, especially as someone who like my whole family is disabled, I know what you mean, but we're also white. And that was just always like something we talked about, is like, oh, we're all disabled. And that's something that stood out to me in your book, is talking about like identity and how in white communities and Black communities, that idea of identity is kind of different.
Yeah, I think there's a big chunk of the book where I really talk through this issue around identity. And for me, as a Black disabled person, it took me a long time to identify as disabled, even though I had been working in the field of disability studies for many years before I identified. And some of it was because of these very narrow, state-based, privileged positions of understanding disability to be associated with, you know, having a diagnosis, receiving certain kinds of care, being on a medication. And so it really took me a while to feel like I could claim that label. You know, I also think about in college, I was like, well, I don't receive any accommodation. So, you know, like I'm not disabled if I don't get this kind of like state support. And I think that that's how a lot of people, particularly Black folks, think about disability. They think of it as if you're not on disability, you're not getting state aid, then you're not disabled. And so the way that we associate it with these like state and medical labels is one reason. But then also the label of disability has been used against Black folks for so long through things like scientific racism, through shuttling Black children into special ed classrooms without a diagnosis or with like a new kind of made up diagnosis. So we know that it's been used to push folks out of receiving care and out of the community and to justify violence against them. And then now we think about it through this like state lens. So it makes sense historically why Black folks have been like, to claim that feels dangerous. It feels dangerous. It's at risk. I talk about in the book, one of the activists that I interview talking to some Black parents of disabled children and asking them, you know, how do you talk about your Blackness? And they're like, oh, it's a point of pride. Like, this is your culture. You never have to hide it. You have to change yourself. And then he says, well, how do you talk to them about their disability? And they're like, well, that's private. Nobody needs to know. It's nobody's business. You don't have to tell anybody ever at all. And so he was trying to bring out to them, like, you're saying then that your Blackness is this cultural, prideful, connecting thing. And a disability is a thing that you should hide and be private of. And they're doing it because they want to protect their kids from ableism. But one of the things that I try to emphasize in the book is that you don't have to identify as disabled to experience ableism. People are going to make assumptions about you. Even if you are a non-disabled Black person, people are still making assumptions about your intellect, about the way that you express your emotions that they associate with disability, and you are being impacted by ableism because of the way that ableism and racism are so deeply intertwined. And so not identifying doesn't actually protect us. And so one of the things that I hope the book can do is help folks start to grapple with that, with their own feelings around identifying as disabled, and understand it as a tool for finding community. And that's ultimately why I ended up identifying more publicly as disabled after doing the interviews for this book, was that I realized that, yeah, it's about finding your people. And then when you find that community, it also means that you can find culture and you can find support and care. I've learned so much through being more public about what's going on with my body and my mind. And then folks saying like, oh, hey, did you know wireless or cordless heating pads exist? And you can actually be walking around with a heating pad if you're having trouble getting to work. And I'm like, oh, that's great. Like these tips and tools and things that we won't know if we're not talking about it and if we're not in community with other disabled people. And so for me, at the end of the day, that's what disability identity does. It brings us into community. It's a tool. It's a path. It is not about a certain fixed thing or identity. And it's definitely not about like, now I get to check this box on some form.
Speaking of community, your book focuses mainly on two activist movements, the Black Panther Party and the National Black Women's Health Project. How did you decide to focus on those groups?
The Black Panther Party was the seed of the book. I read Alondra Nelson's book, Body and Soul, which is about the Black Panthers' health activism. It's an incredible book. Highly recommend the folks read it. And in the book, she cites Irving Zola, who's kind of considered one of the very, very early disability studies scholars. And reading her book made me realize that if I wanted to be looking at or finding examples of Black activism around disability, I needed to be looking much more closely at health activism and really thinking about how the language of disability might not be being used, but we're definitely talking about disabled folks, right? So particularly for me, her analysis of their sickle cell anemia awareness and testing campaigns, it just clicked something in my head. And so it started with the Black Panther Party. And I really thought I was just going to write like a one chapter to just kind of give this like historical overview or a historical precedent. And then I learned about the National Black Women's Health Project, and I was already going to, their archives are at Smith College. I was already going to Smith for a talk. So I was like, okay, I'm going to check out their archive as well and just see, maybe there's something else. And there was so much in both of these archives between the Huey Newton papers are at Stanford, and then many of the newspapers are digitized now. And I ended up writing four chapters on these two groups. And so what originally was supposed to be one or two short historical chapters setting up the rest of a book became the heart of the book itself. And so with the support of my editor at Duke, we made the shift, and then the book became much more about this history than it was like the history setting up contemporary work. Yeah.
And speaking of that contemporary work, you also spent time interviewing Black disabled activists for the book. What impacted you the most from those interviews, or what connections did you see between those historical movements you learned about and the activists you talked to?
I think this emphasis on health was really important, and health systems that we're still really thinking about, the way that health systems were leaving Black folks out, making it more difficult for Black folks to not just identify or understand themselves as disabled, but to actually get support, accommodations, and care. So I think that thread was there. the grappling with disability identity and the label of disability was still there. And for me, as I said, these interviews are what helped me decide that I needed to publicly identify as disabled, even though, you know, I had an internal understanding and definitely among friends, there was a shared understanding, but I wasn't saying that publicly. So those interviews really shifted that for me. And I just became friends with some folks, you know, I really just made connections and found a specifically Black disabled community that I didn't have before that. I was in the disability studies community. I knew plenty of disabled people, but there was something about having these long conversations with Black disabled activists specifically that really shifted my orientation to disability studies, to disability identity and disability community.
That kind of brings up a question in my mind. Are there not enough spaces for Black disabled people to just have that social space to have those conversations? Are those just not, I don't know, like promoted, created as often?
Yeah, I think so. In part, some of us are really spread out. That's part of it, you know. But because it is hard to get folks to identify as disabled, it can really be a challenge to come together under that umbrella specifically. And so what you might see is like a group of gun violence survivors gathering to talk about their experience. And so many of them are talking about the mentally and physically disabling impacts of that, but they're not necessarily calling themselves a Black disabled group. And so what we see is much more folks gathering around specific identity or disability experiences. So saying like, this is a group of diabetics, right? But not necessarily just disability writ large. So I think that that's part of it. But I will say Vylissa Thompson is one of the folks that I interviewed for the book. And last summer, she did a Black disability conference that centered particularly Black disabled women and femmes. And that was incredible. It was the first time that I had ever experienced, even though it was a virtual space, a space where we were so centered and lifted up and so many people gathering and having conversations. And so her work is incredible. Ramp Your Voice. I really just want to, shout out Vylissa.
You know, and I think a lot of people have become familiar with the Disability Pride movement and have seen disability awareness campaigns. But as you point out in your book, they often center white people and white privilege. I guess as people are creating new spaces, new movements, new initiatives, what do these disability movements need to change or keep in mind in order to center disabled people of color?
So I think one, keeping in mind, again, that folks might not identify as disabled. And so if you're putting out a call about an event or about a gathering, you might want to say, you know, folks with disabilities, but you could name some of what that is. Like if you have a chronic illness, if you have a mental health condition, like you can name those things and provide people a lot of different language that might resonate with them in a way that just disability does not. So I think keeping that in mind. And then I think the other thing is because there are a lot of Black disabled folks who are still new coming into a disability community, one of the things that I've seen in disability spaces that is really troubling is that we love our language. Before we started, you asked me about, you know, person first versus identity first language, right? And there are certain words that we don't use inside of the disability community anymore. And so when somebody comes in who's new and they're using the wrong language, I've seen people get shut down, and particularly people of color get shut down by white disabled people who say, oh, we don't say special. You're not saying it right. And they're not actually listening to what the person is saying or trying to express or the question they're asking. They hear the language that we consider ableist, that we consider wrong, and they shut it all down. And if you're a person who's new to a community and you're coming in and there's a bunch of white people telling you that you're speaking in the wrong way, you're not coming back. You're not coming back. And so if we can think about ways to be more generous and open and understanding that people are at different places in their identity journey and their understanding of disability politics, I think we're much more likely to build a broader, like, multiracial coalition. And I think that's especially important in this moment of a continued pandemic where more and more folks living with long COVID, that's going to be a lot of folks in poverty. That's going to be a lot of folks of color, right? Because we know that getting early access to treatment is what prevents long COVID, and that it's less likely to happen if you are a person of color, a person in poverty. And so we've got all these people who are newly disabled, and we need to not be, yelling at them to use the right language right away and actually trying to help them figure out, again, come into community first, learn, rather than pushing people out because they're not doing it perfectly immediately.
Absolutely. I love what you just said about language because I do trainings on disability reporting. And a lot of times organizations approach me and they're like, we want you to do a training about language. And I'm like, it cannot just be about language. So there is no right way of talking about disability. A lot of times I feel like people just want like some sort of dictionary of language about our community handed to them. And that doesn't exist because we're not a monolith. So it becomes a lot of just educating on history and ways of thinking about disability. Because I know Eric Garcia, who's another great disabled journalist, he said to me once, you know, what someone says in quotes to you is the Bible. You don't change it. You don't correct their language. It's how they talk about something. So I'm really glad you brought up the language point, because I think it's people get so focused on correcting each other, they don't hear each other anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And since it's Black History Month, I do want to ask, how can people engage in learning more about Black disability history? I feel like a lot of our textbooks whitewash history, and then also disability history just isn't included. So what are some sources or resources that stand out to you as being accessible and a good place to start?
Yeah, the Longmore Center has a virtual version of their Patient No More exhibit, which is about Section 504, which currently, I guess, they're trying to take away. So definitely a time to learn about the history of 504. Again, Vylissa Thompson's website, Ramp Your Voice, does a great job of highlighting some Black disability history. And then in terms of scholarship, I would say the work of Stephen Nadler, Dee Boster, Cherie Pickens, Dennis Tyler, Anna Hinton. These are all folks who are doing really great work highlighting either historically or through literature, culture, Black disability history. And so those are scholarly sources that I would point people towards.
Fantastic. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that Buffalo's East Side, which is a predominantly Black neighborhood, experienced a racist massacre on May 14th, 2022. And leading up to it and after it, Black activists on our East Side have been really pushing for more awareness of the disablement that happens because of redlining and because of food deserts. And I think that it's, I don't know, there's no other word than it's like, it's horrible that it took a shooting for it to get national attention that people are being disabled by redlining and food deserts still today. I guess I'm wondering, do you have any message for those Black disabled activists in Buffalo who are trying to keep this conversation around their community alive and funded and focused and cared about?
I mean, I think the main thing is to just keep going and that it matters. One of the folks that I interviewed, T.L. Lewis, T.L.'s work focuses on disabled and particularly deaf folks inside of the prison industrial complex. And TL talks about how when you're working against these huge systems, so when we're thinking about redlining, so deeply historic, like so much time that to create and embed these systems, that you really have to focus on every single win. And so I would encourage folks to remember that, like, every person that you impact, every person whose mind you change a little bit, all of that is a win. It's not all going to happen right away, especially again when we're fighting these very large systems. But the large systems and the focus on the big wins only is one of the ways that we lose sight, right? That we think that it doesn't matter what we do. And so I would just say that as you keep going, really take the time to recognize those wins along the way, because they are making a difference, often in ways that are imperceptible, that you won't see, that you won't know, sometimes for years, but it's there. And so the work still matters, even if we're not seeing immediate, like, structural or policy changes. It takes time.
Thank you again for joining me on WBFO. I know your work's making an impact. It's impacted me, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I just want to circle back to when you were asking for resources for Black History Month. I also want to say PBS put out a documentary, a short on Brad Lomax. And so I'm in it, but I think that that's another great one for folks to check out.
I'm Emily Watkins, and you just heard my recent conversation with disability scholar and author Dr. Sammy Schock. For the link to her book and the resources mentioned, as well as a transcript, visit WBFO.org. And stay tuned. We've got more important conversations this hour as Jay Moran speaks with Cindy Volker from Spectrum Health next on What's Next on WBFO.
Morning Edition, All Things Considered, What's Next, and Group Chat need your support. Sign up for updates on federal funding for public media at protectmypublicmedia.org to ensure WBFO continues to bring you the news and entertainment you rely on.
Celebrate the 50th anniversary season of Austin City Limits. Don't miss remarkable performances from Gary Clark Jr., Black Pumas, Brittany Howard, and more. Watch every Monday at 10 p.m. on WNED PBS.
This is Jack Cruiser with the scoreboard on WBFO. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of the scoreboard at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And this is What's Next. This morning, we're going to be talking with Cindy Volker. Cindy is the president and CEO of Spectrum Health and Human Services. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we love talking about the types of services that Spectrum offers, of course, and that's a subject matter that we most certainly have touched upon frequently on this program. But recently, the Patrick Lee Foundation awarded you guys a $200,000 grant. This is interesting because of what that money is needed for. You, very much like here at Buffalo-Toronto Public Media, sustained some fairly significant damage during that Christmas blizzard of 2022, which seems sounds a long time ago, but for you, I know, and your crew, feels very much a recent endeavor. What exactly happened over at your Main Street location?
Well, so the best that we can figure is on that Friday night of the 22nd when the storm started, the wind blew a window out on the top floor. It's at 1280 Main Street, so it's right next to the Delta Sonic down on Main Street in Main and Bryant. And it froze the sprinkler system on the top floor of the building, which is the third floor of a 40,000 square foot building. And the sprinklers broke in two spots, so the water started pouring out of there. And we really didn't get a notification to our operations guy, who had no power for 2 days until Sunday, that there was something going on at the building. Of course, there was really, I mean, there were so many other tragic things going on. You're not going to get, you know, the police or the fire company to come to your building, right? So, I mean, it is an interesting story because my husband and I, who happened to live about, you know, right near Snyder area, got into my husband's 4Runner and we drove down Main Street and went to the building, and the water was pouring out of the building.
Oh, literally coming out of the building.
Literally pouring out of the building, out of the windows. And so, you know, we actually went into the building, into the basement, and followed the directions of our operations guy, got into the maintenance room, and then were able to get the what we needed to turn the water wheel of the water into the building.
Oh, my.
And it was just pouring down the whole thing. So I knew at that point it was really bad, you know. But in a lot of ways, I was like, well, no one's, you know, dead. It's not. It's a building. We'll fix it, right? You know, so. But so we were able to get the water off, which the only fortunate thing is it saved the heating system that we had, which was an antiquated system down in the basement, which it stopped just the level of running did not go out. And then it also, we were able to save the server room, which was down there as well for all of our servers. Because we had built that kind of, you know, in a way that was more protected. So that was the beginning of how it all happened. And
the road back has been long and continues as we speak here, almost 2+ years afterwards. Yeah. So what was the damage estimate finally on the building?
$15 million to replace everything because, you know, it had to have all new windows. You know, first of all, it had to be all brought up to code. To get approvals, you know, going forward. It was an old building. It's over 100 years old. It's been many different things over the years. And we, you know, had put some money into it over time, but, you know, replacing a whole building of windows is,
right,
you know,
right,
difficult for a not-for-profit agency. But so it needed a lot of those things, and just the entire thing had to be gutted. We had a, you know, just the first year was really just getting it to the point where we could rebuild. So there was a, obviously an under, you know, under insurance, which resulted from a lot of things, you know, costs just going up, right, for everything, and just has gone up continuously as we're working on it, right? And also, you know, just that, you know, the code piece and all those things that we just didn't anticipate you would have to replace everything at one time, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Lessons learned.
Right.
You know.
How many people work in that building or worked in that building?
Yeah, we had
say?
Over 125 employees. We had, you know, about 6 different programs that we have that were out of there. So those staff had to be deployed to different places 2 years later now. So.
Wow. So let's take a step then before we start talking about the specific services in that, mm-hmm, building. Let's just talk about Spectrum overall, because
sure,
it's a, as we were talking before we were on the air, Spectrum's been around for about 50 years right,
mm-hmm,
now. It's a name that we kind of all know about. I'm sure every once in a while you get confused with the local or the national cable company, which
yes,
I'm
that's
sure
that's why we went with Spectrum Health and Human Services.
Spectrum Health and Human Services. But what are the services that are provided by Spectrum?
Mm-hmm. Well, Spectrum is a not-for-profit community behavioral health center located across 7 different counties in western New York. And we do, I'd say half of our business is doing certified community behavioral health center clinics. So we do integrated mental health, behavioral health with addiction issues, and helping people recover from serious illness all the way from people with depression, anxiety. We also work with kids and families. We're in some of the schools. We're in pediatricians' offices, doctors' offices. So we do a lot of just basic mental health and addiction work across those regions. And then we specialize in a lot of community-based programs. So we do ACT teams, assertive community treatment teams that go out into the community and take a doctor, a nurse, and other staff. We do that in Niagara County, Erie County, and Cattaraugus County. We have care coordinators that are like case managers that help link people to services. We do reentry for people coming out of prison and out of the forensic system under the Office of Mental Health. And we work with parole and probation to help people, you know, make it successfully back into the community and help them with those things. We have a large supportive housing program where we support people in individual apartments within the community. So that's that, and provide case management and support so people can, you know, homeless individuals who finally get their, you know, back into being able to be housed. So we do a lot of services that, you know, meet community needs for a lot of people that have a lot of serious issues and, you know, need a lot of support in the community.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like all the different services you're talking about, whether it's helping out people who had been previously homeless, people who have suffered from addiction, mental health issues as well. All on the rise? All that demand? Is that demand on the rise?
All on the rise.
Yeah?
Yes.
What can you tell me about that? Mm-hmm. What do we understand? We've touched on the mm-hmm. subject frequently on this mm-hmm. program,
yep.
so I most certainly
I've
am familiar
that.
With that. But
mm-hmm.
at the same time, I'd like to hear your take on, you know, why this is happening and just mm-hmm. how prevalent mm-hmm. it is.
So if there's quite a few things I think that happened. I mean, there has been obviously since the COVID, during COVID and post-COVID, we've seen, you know, just way more people seeking care. I think part of that is there was a lot more talk about depression, anxiety, people struggling, you know, more outreach programs and more people saying that it's okay to do that. So a little bit of the stigma, I think, has gone away in terms of it's okay to get help and you should get help. And so
that's a positive.
More
a positive
people
problem.
Are
yeah.
asking for help, right?
Yeah.
So that helps. I think also that for people who have more serious issues, you know, there's the hospital, there's, you know, less hospital space for mm. people. There's less places for people to go that need a higher level of care where they need more protected environment. There's very, you know, the system is moved towards a community base, which works for a lot of people, but for some people it's more challenging. So you've expanded a lot of those programs. So a lot of your staff now are spread between a lot of programs, you know, and the state's been working to, you know, fund programs. I mean, New York has a lot of services compared to a lot
Absolutely.
Of states.
Right.
We really are very fortunate. But I think so there's that piece of it. And then, you know, the homelessness, you know, that obviously it's very challenging, even when you have some resources to get people reasonable, you know, accommodations that they can afford with support from our programs because of the cost of rents have gone up and, you know, people's difficulties maintaining their cost of living, which then leads to homelessness or stress about that, that leads to addiction issues being exacerbated, leads to mental health. So I think that, and then just one other thing is that probably the most concerning is we've seen a big increase in youth having mental health issues and maybe even more so than addiction issues, like mental health and serious, like suicide attempts. It's really been, I think all of us that do those services are like, wow, we have, that is a problem we have to keep working at.
And when we're talking youth, it could be any age.
You're talking from, you know, age of six, you know, 7 years old into the teens, where there's that is the biggest increase of suicide attempts and some completed in our business in the last few years. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about what contributes to that, you know, how do we get to that? But there is a lot of services and things going on now and trying to address those issues. So all in all, the other part of it is we all have less staff and there has been not enough workforce to keep up with the demand. So that's something we've all, you know, been, you know, challenged to figure out ways to work with.
And maybe let's talk about that then. How, you know, from your perspective now, you know, you moved through this organization over four decades at a variety of levels. Yeah. Now you're at the top looking over it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So how have you and your organization, have you adjusted to this increased need?
Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, we have looked at how to provide the services where people need them. So going more into integrating into, you know, schools, into the community, putting smaller clinics in different places where people could easily access what you're doing. And then also there's the virtual piece of it that we all still do a little bit of that helps people more in rural areas or they can't get out of their home and things like that. The workforce issue, there's been a big movement to also certify and train individuals that we call peers, so people who have had experiences themselves with mental health or addiction. And then in New York State, you can get certification under both of those, and you can get a job with any of our agencies. Most of us have those types of jobs, but we've built a lot into a department that supports that. So that brings a whole other piece of it, but it gives you another workforce to support people. Clinical clinicians and, you know, master's social workers, licensed mental health counselors, we do a lot of us, you know, what we've done is we develop very good intern programs for internships. We, you know, try to be, you know, family friendly, flexible, all the things you hear. But we do, I think right now it's really focusing on training and interns and, you know, being a place where people want to come to. And we work with a lot of schools across the region to do that. So there's been a lot of concerted efforts on many fronts to try to keep the workforce and train them.
I'm interested about the intern program in the sense that are we also seeing maybe individuals, younger people who have a sensitivity to what the types of issues we've already talked about, mental health issues, and are maybe finding their way into this field?
Yes. I mean, many times people find their way into the field for that very reason. They've experienced that or someone in their family has, and they really want to help people. I mean, the people that work for all of us, they want to help people. That's why they're there. Right. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to be getting rich. You know, I mean, it's like, it's, you have to be very dedicated to wanting to help people, which is what we do. But yes, I think you do see a lot of people that kind of find their way because of the experiences. And as I say, a lot of times it's very hard not to find a family or a person that you talk to that you could say, do you not know someone who has had addiction or mental health issues?
Right.
You know, that's very rare, you know, that you don't know that. So that is a plus, but it can also be stressful for people when they get into the field as well, because there's a lot to deal with. So you have to provide a lot of support for that.
I was going to just get into that. Yeah. What about the support? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you go about maybe assessing that and trying to... A lot of it's got to be as much anticipating as it is reacting.
Yeah. So I think we call it supervision. So you know, you have one-on-one supervision. So somebody helps you understand what you're doing and supports everything. And then you also, you know, provide training. And then you also provide training on how you deal with those things. So wellness kinds of things in terms of the special circumstances for all of our staff. You're dealing with, you know, a lot of situations and you hear things that are, you know, difficult to hear sometimes. So it really is a culture that you have to develop of, you know, a lot of it is called trauma that people have been through. So you try to, you know, minimize that for everybody and support the staff. And, you know, work as a team. I think having a team working with you, which is a little bit different for our agencies versus somebody who's in a private practice, right? So you're just doing it yourself. It's very different if you can depend on, you've got a psychiatrist here, a nurse practitioner, a nurse, a doctor, a counselor, a peer, you know, so that we work as a team to provide that kind of experience for the individuals that work for us, as well as the individuals that we serve in the communities.
We're talking with Cindy Volker, the president and CEO of Spectrum Health and Human Services, on What's Next. I want to say a typical case, but look, take me through a case, if you could. You said there's a team approach to things, but let's, you know, I'll let you pick out the, you know, whether it's an addiction service or a mental health service. Take us through how, first maybe how the person is identified or comes to Spectrum, and then take us through the hopeful process of getting somebody back, you know, on their feet, so to speak.
And, you know, I think I can do that from kind of a personal perspective, because I've had family members and friends that'll call me, and I can think of one particular case and say, this is happening with my son, and, you know, and I don't know what to do, and there's all these symptoms, and, you know, and I'm right away going, okay, I know how it can be difficult to negotiate the system, right? Where do you go?
Absolutely.
How do you get
right.
help?
Right.
How can you be seen right away? So we have several places where you could walk in, which, of course, was at 1280, one of our biggest locations, where you could just walk in and get anybody to help you anytime right. you needed it. So, you know, we would have, you could get an appointment that day, have somebody see you, help you with the immediate needs. What's the immediate crisis? We could have you see a doctor or nurse practitioner that day if we needed to. Maybe you need to go to the hospital, which happened with this individual I'm thinking about. You got to work with CPAP, emergency room over DCMC. Then they're evaluated and not admitted, and then you got to develop a comprehensive plan to keep them safe. Give them our crisis line, you know, make sure they've got some medications if they needed a safe place to go. So maybe you need, you know, the housing to help you with something depending on their circumstance. But, you know, I think in this case, it's for me, I think about, you know, get the immediate help, get kind of a diagnosis of an idea of what's going on. What are the things we need to put in place to make this person safe and to be able to get to a point where we can start more treatment and then, you know, link up with the other services. So I think what you want is that you want immediate help when you need it, because what good does it do you if you have to wait, if you're really in a crisis? And then you want somebody assessing really what your needs are and then implementing that plan with you and your family or whoever is close to you that can help you. So
it's
it takes a lot to do that.
And
really.
Usually more than one staff member is
yes,
of, like we said,
yes,
a team
yes.
approach.
And then, of course, a lot of people are challenged with maybe the individual doesn't really want the help. Or maybe they're not sure they need the help, or they don't trust you. So, you know, you have to keep working at that and trying to, we always say, meet the person where they're at and just kind of figure out what's going to work with that.
Maybe address that just while we have you here, since this is something that's obviously very much part of who you are in dealing with this. But, all right, there you brought it up. There was a situation in a family or a friend who is showing to whoever the observer is, that there is a problem, mental health problem, maybe an addiction problem. Talk us through how maybe somebody can advocate and help bring somebody to that awareness and you know, how it might be the best way to lead that.
Well, obviously, I mean, there's probably a lot of people listening who'll say that I've been through that, and it's a tough spot
yes,
to be in.
Definitely.
Because it's very hard to get someone who's not really wanting that or seeing that at the time. I think what we've had the most luck with is, you know, if you can get someone to actually come and see you. If you can't, maybe we can go see you, and maybe we can see you where you're at, you know, and then you can kind of engage the person in more of a dialogue and a discussion, not necessarily a very medical model, you know, ask me a million questions, you know, figure it out. So we try to, if it really is more of that, it's more like somebody meeting you and coming to talk to you and your family and trying to engage you and, you know, this is what we could do with you. We could help you, you know. So I think...
So it's not a step. If you take that step, you as a family member, it's not a commitment of any kind. It's more, let's just see what the possibilities are. Let's maybe kind of come up with a diagnosis. Yeah.
Right. And then I think, you know, we've also got, like I said, individuals who are family advocate peers and peers who actually sometimes talking to those individuals about, I've been through this. I know how you're feeling. I can help with that. On the other hand, sometimes when it's so critical, somebody just needs to be brought in and people do that. And then you have to take a little bit more control of trying to make sure they're safe, trying to make sure you're doing what you're doing. using your resources if you have to get them to a hospital. I mean, so there's a whole range of what you do depending on how serious the situation is.
And you know, we brought you in to talk about what happened at 1280 Main. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Cindy Volker from Spectrum Health and Human Services. Back in the legendary, infamous blizzard of 2022, their building, very much similar to our building here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, underwent a flood of epic proportions. In your case, though, it basically ruined the most of the building, if not the entire building. Here we were fortunate it was kind of sectored to the west side of this particular structure. But that, all that being stated, one of the things you mentioned is the counseling. One of your key walk-in locations was at 1280 Main. Right. How did you adjust to that?
Well, unfortunately, we had just before that, even during right in COVID, we had just opened the first urgent care center for behavioral health under our certified community behavioral health center and had a grand opening. We have pictures and we were all wearing masks, but it was a great thing because people could just come anytime and get the care when they couldn't go to CPAP or it was, you know, instead of doing that. So, you know, that, so we had a lot of availability for that. So we had to, luckily, I will say one thing. So we switched over very quickly because everybody had laptops at home and they didn't leave them in the office because we knew there was a storm. So they all left with their laptops.
Okay.
So that following Monday when we were ready to start business again, or maybe it was a holiday because it was Christmas on Sunday. So on the Tuesday, we were able to start reaching out to all of individuals that we were scheduled to see and, you know, set up virtual or telephonic visits until we had another plan in place. So quickly we moved to find alternate space at our own locations. We have a place at City Mission, an office, but we got extra space from them. We, you know, we also were able to lease space from St. Vincent de Paul across the street from us, which is where we're still at, for a fraction of the space we had before, but a lot of our individuals we serve in that community could go there. So we went really quickly to this mode of just trying to, you know, make sure we didn't miss a beat to be in touch with the people that we were serving. And I have to say, you know, that is one credit to the COVID era because we would have never been able to do that before, you know, because we just didn't have this equipment and set up that way or the system. So, you know, I think I give credit to my staff and all the people that were just ready to do whatever it took. And then some of them just going out to see people in the community. And then the community staff that work out of there, they just would work out of their homes till we set up different places. So, but what we lost was the ability for people to have a place to come to that's safe. That they know
had it already become, built a reputation of being a place, a safe place where people could come?
Yeah, I mean, Spectrum has had a location on in that corridor of Main Street for 35 years.
Okay.
We'd been across the street, and then we had the opportunity to move into 1280, and then we had the opportunity to buy the building, which is the only building Spectrum owns. So we were able to, you know, but that building, you know, before us, ECMC was in there, you know, their, you know, Lakeshore / Best Self was, I mean, so there was a lot of providers for years have been in that building. So people in the communities, both, you know, east and west side of Main Street, we're used to being able to come there if you need help.
Okay.
So it had kind of developed that reputation anyway for that. So, and for a lot of people, it was walking distance or easy bus trip. So I think, you know, that was lost in terms of that access, you know, which is what we're hoping to get back.
So it's not, it's not up and running yet.
No. So we're still working on additional funding to close the gap from what our insurance covered. Which was why we're so grateful to Patrick Lee for that kind of a capital grant, which was very generous of them. We're looking to other state grants that we've applied for and other foundations. And then, you know, we are at a point where we can open part of, you know, part of the floors and then gradually, I mean, you know, 40,000-50,000 square feet is a lot of space.
Yes, and it is.
We, you know, we're going to build back our clinic services. And we do still have staff in St. Vincent de Paul, which, you know, has been very nice of them to help with, you know, having a sublease space over there because that's right on the corner from us. So people, we do see people there. So, and at other locations, and some of the landlords we'd work with that we had office space very generously gave us temporary space. And so I think it takes a concerted effort for everybody. But the goal is to get back there. We're hoping by the summer, early summer, late, you know, that we're hoping to do.
Funding dependent, though? Is that
it is funding dependent,
yeah.
Right? So we're, you know, we're really, you know, we're looking at ways to do it without having to go into big debt, right? So, yes, we could take out a further loan and mortgage and, you know, but, you know, I mean, those are big decisions you have to make.
Sure.
With being wise in terms of how you do that. So I'm optimistic that we're going to get there. It's just a difficult road, kind of, you know.
Absolutely. To get there. Like I said, we can relate to it, right? Here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media. I mean, you're outside, you know,
where it was.
Ground zero to a certain extent here. This portion of the building has been repaired, but still the other floors above and beyond, above and below,
oh, wow,
still have yet to be completed. So it's, you know, we understand how it can be still 2+ years afterwards. So when it's all said and done, though, and if it goes according to hope and plan, will there be something different about the new rebuilt facility?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is that, first of all, it'll be, you know, our CFO, Nick Jerome, he'll say state-of-the-art place, but it'll be so much more updated and more, you know, just everything more efficient. And also just, you know, in terms of the heating and all those things, just much more economical and much more, you know, efficient in terms of the environment stuff. But it'll be a safer building as well because, you know, we can now take in this, how do we build this? How do we make it, you know, the best structure? I mean, older buildings, you know, you put up walls, you take down walls,
right,
you do this, you
right,
do that, whatever. So we were able to design, you know, what do we need for the individuals we're serving? What's going to serve? There'll be community space for people to be able to, you know, come and use there. And we're looking at ways we can help all the individuals in the community have a better place to be. So I think it'll be so much better than what we had. And it'll be like that for many, many years, right? It's a huge, I mean, it'll be a huge investment. So it all has all new windows in now, so it looks great from the outside.
That's good. And more efficient, more comfortable, of course. So what about some staff back in the building now, yeah?
No, not yet.
No, not at all.
Not yet. Not,
so
not
it's
at
still,
all.
Wow.
We're still, right. So
2+ years.
Yeah, right. Whoa. That's really challenging for the staff as well.
Of course.
You know, no, so we would then gradually bring, and then we'd be able to expand more of our clinic staff and our, we call it CCBHC, Certified Community Behavioral Health Centers, staff. We'd be able to get back to where we were before because we haven't had the capacity to put people in offices to do that. So, you know, that would be the first step. That is our first step of who's going back in and how do we build that back up to what we need in the community to serve, you know, the people that need it. And all of us have had, you know, I mean, I say all of us, I speak for all the other agencies because we work closely together anyway.
Yes.
All of us. And, you know, have had those challenges to try to meet the demands in the community. So.
Yeah. And so is there enough, and when it's all said and done, I mean, obviously the building's its own issue, but in terms of staffing, do you have enough staffing right now?
I think we have seen a little bit of a shift where it's stabilizing a little bit. So we've have less open positions,
okay,
most of us, and we fill more positions than we lose. So that's a big, that
yes,
sounds like a sort of a strange marker, but that is kind of where
right,
we got to in
right,
the last few years. So I do think it's going up, and we do see more people seeming to be going into the field. And there are some incentive programs, you know, that have been put in place in New York State to help people with their costs for education if you go into this field, you know, those kind of things. So that helps, you know, in terms of people because it's expensive to get. And I think, you know, we've really worked to stabilize that. So is there enough? No, not yet.
Okay.
But I think we're making progress in the right way.
But on the other side of the coin, though, back to what you said about some of the available funding that might be there for people that are interested, let's just get into that for just a little bit before we finish our conversation. Somebody who's listening right now and said, oh, you know, I might have an interest in that field. Maybe take us through the possibilities of somebody who could maybe go to your website and see the opportunities that are there. They might not have the qualifications. Is there a way to learn and work at the same time? What can you tell us?
So I think you can, if you go to the Office of Mental Health sites and the Office of the Alcohol Addictions sites, OASIS we call it, those have sites where you could also learn about some of the certifications there. But with you might have heard the 1115B waiver that's coming out with social determinants of care help for people that, you know, New York State was awarded, as long as we continue to get the award. There's a whole piece of that for employment and training for health professionals, and mental health professionals fall under that. So there is an organization that will be rolling out those resources. It isn't quite ready for that yet, but there will be one. So you could get reimbursement for going to some of those programs, which is nursing, mental health counseling, and those kind of things. But I think if you're interested in looking at those kind of entry-level jobs, that you can see what's the easiest way to get in the door. And then most, you know, what we do is then try to help people get the continued education once
okay,
they're there and be flexible and help them move up that ladder of, you know, more education. I think if anybody has an interest, they should just, you know, they could reach out to our our agency or, you know, and anybody would talk with them in terms of our training department or our HR department of what's the best pathway. Or I would talk with them because I've had people reach out to me and say, well, right. How do I do this? How could I get in here? How could I do that? So I think if anybody has an interest, you can help them find a way.
And to take that another step in terms of somebody who's listening, they look themselves in the mirror. Am I meant for this? Are there, I'm sure you have all your staff, you have a big staff, so there are a lot of different personalities involved, but, you know, are there core elements that people need to know about mm-hmm. themselves before they make this journey down this road?
That's a good question. I think maybe the core element is, do you, at your core, believe people can get help and that you can help them? You know what I mean? Like, do you have hope? And do you also have compassion for other people? And do you have compassion for yourself? So if you can kind of see yourself, how you've dealt with yourself and your own family, and you can see that translating to helping people, and you think you can, you know, tolerate a lot of challenging things, then I think you're meant for that job.
Well, obviously you've been doing it for four decades.
four decades.
It's been rewarding for you.
It has been extremely rewarding. I've been very fortunate to do all the things I've done and work with all the people I have.
Cindy Volker is the president and CEO of Spectrum Health and Human Services. Cindy, thanks for joining us on What's Next.
Thank you so much for having me.